understanding of what this purpose was. I regarded this, politely, as utter balderdash. What little interaction there was between our worlds was nothing but a cruel aberration, the enslavement of us djinn, which should be terminated as soon as possible. Our argument had become heated, and earthly vulgarities were avoided only by my concern for rhetorical purity. One or two scholars passed us as we went. Disputatious Greeks, lean Romans, hot of eye and scrubbed of skin, dark Nabataeans, and courteous diplomats from Mero and far Parthia, all here to drink knowledge from the deep Egyptian wells. As we were about to leave the library compound, a clash of horns sounded in the street below. Up came a little knot of soldiers, the Ptolemaic colours aflutter on their pikes. They drew apart to reveal Ptolemy's cousin, the king's son and heir to the throne of Egypt, slowly swaggering up the steps. In his train came an adoring cluster of favourites, toadies and fawners to a man. They included senior priests, nobles of the realm, flophouse drinking partners, professional wrestlers, a bearded lady, and a midget. The king's son had a jaded appetite and broad tastes. His social circle was wide. My master and I stopped. We inclined our heads in the traditional manner of respect. "Cousin!" The king's son lolled to a stop. His tunic was tight about his stomach, wet where the brief walk had drawn sweat from his flesh. His face was blurry with wine, his aura sagged with it. His eyes were dull coins under their heavy lids. "Cousin," he said again, "thought I'd pay you a little visit." Ptolemy bowed again. "My lord, it is an honour, of course." "Thought I'd see where you skulk away your days instead of staying at my side," he took a breath, "like a loyal cousin should." The toadies tittered. "Philip and Alexander and all my other cousins are accounted for," he went on, tumbling over the words. "They fight for us in the desert. They work as ambassadors in principalities east and west. They prove their loyalty to our dynasty. But you—" A pause. He picked at the wet cloth of his tunic. "Well, can we rely on you?" "In whatever way you wish me to serve." "But can we, Ptolemaeus? You cannot hold a sword or draw a bow with those girlish arms of yours. So where's your strength, eh? Up here?" He tapped his head with an unsteady finger. "That's what I've heard. Up here. What do you do in this dismal place, then, out of the sun?" Ptolemy bowed his head modestly. "I study, my lord. The papyri and books of record that the worthy priests have compiled time out of mind. Works of history and religion. And magic, too, by all accounts. Forbidden works." That was a tall priest, black-robed, head-shaven, and with white clay daubed faintly around his eyes. He spat the words out softly like a cobra shooting venom. He was probably a magician himself.
"Ha, yes, all manner of wickednesses."
The king's son lurched a little closer. Sour fumes hung about his clothes and issued from his mouth.
"The people celebrate you for it, cousin. You use your magic to beguile them, to win them over to you. I hear they come daily to your house to witness your devilry. I hear all kinds of stories."
Ptolemy pursed his lips.
"Do you, my lord? That is beyond my understanding. It is true that I am pestered by some of those who have fallen low in fortune. I offer them advice, nothing more. I am just a boy, weak, as you say, and unworldly. I prefer to remain alone, seeking nothing but a little knowledge."
The affectation of humility, for it was affectation, Ptolemy's hunger for knowledge was just as ravenous as the king's son's lust for power, and far more virile, seemed to enrage the prince into a passion. His face grew dark as uncooked meat. Little snakes of spittle swayed at the corner of his mouth.
"Knowledge, eh?" he cried.
"Yes, but of what kind, and to what end?
Scrolls and styluses are nothing to a proper man, but in the hands of white-skinned necromancers they can be deadlier than the strongest iron. In old Egypt, they say, eunuchs mustered armies with the stamp of a foot and swept the rightful pharaohs into the sea. I don't intend that to happen to me. What are you smirking about, slave?
I hadn't meant to smile. It's just I enjoyed his account, having been in the vanguard of the army that did the sweeping 1,000 years before. It's good when you make an impression. I bowed and scraped.
Nothing, master, nothing. You smirked. I saw you. You dare laugh at me, the king-in-waiting.
His voice quivered. The soldiers knew the signs. Their pikes made small adjustments. Ptolemy uttered placatory noises.
He did not intend offence, my lord. My scribe was born with an unfortunate facial tic, a grimace that in harsh light can seem a baleful smirk. It is a sad affliction.
I will have his head stuck above the crocodile gate. Guards!
The soldiers lowered their pikes, each keener than the rest, drenched the stones with my blood. I waited meekly for the inevitable, i.e. a whirlwind of slaughter, carried out by me.
Ptolemy stepped forward. Please, cousin, this is ridiculous. I beg you—
No, I will hear no argument. The slave will die.
Then I must tell you.
My master was suddenly very close to his brutish cousin. He seemed somehow taller, his equivalent in height. His dark eyes gazed directly into the other's watery ones, which squirmed in their sockets like a fish upon a spear. The king's son quailed and shrank from him. His soldiers and attendants shifted uneasily. The sun's warmth dimmed. The courtyard grew cloudy. One or two of the soldiers had goose pimples on their legs.
"You will leave him alone," Ptolemy said, his voice slow and clear. "He is my slave, and I say he deserves no punishment. Leave with your lackeys and return to your wine vats. Your presence here disturbs the scholars and brings no credit on our family, your insinuations likewise. Do you understand?"
The king's son had bent so far back to avoid the piercing stare that half his cape dragged on the ground. He made a noise like a marsh toad mating.
"Yes," he croaked. "Yes."
Ptolemy stepped away. Instantly he seemed to dwindle. The darkness that had gathered around the little group like a winter cloud lifted and was gone. The onlookers relaxed. Priests rubbed the backs of their necks. Nobles exhaled noisily. A midget peeped out from behind a wrestler.
"Come, Rickett."
Ptolemy repositioned the scrolls under his arm and glanced at the king's son with studious disinterest.
"Goodbye, cousin. I am late for lunch."
He made to step past. The king's son, white-faced and tottering, uttered an incoherent word. He lurched forward. From beneath his cloak a knife was drawn. With a snarl he lunged at Ptolemy's side. I raised a hand and gestured. There was a muffled impact, as of a masonry block landing on a bag of suet pudding. The king's son doubled over, clutching his solar plexus, mouth bubbling, eyes popping. He sank to his knees. The knife dropped impotently on the stones. Ptolemy kept walking. Four of the soldiers sprang to uncertain life. Their pikes went low, they made aggressive sounds. I swept my hands in a semicircle. Away they flew, one after the other, head first, toes last, out across the courtyard cobbles. One hit a Roman, another a Greek, a third skidded a yard upon his nose. The fourth crashed into a trader's stand and was half buried by an avalanche of sweetmeats. They lay outstretched like points upon a sundial. The others in the group were chicken. They cowered together and made no move. I kept close watch upon the old bald priest, though. I could see he was tempted to do something. But he met my eyes and decided it was best to live. Ptolemy kept walking. I followed after. We went in search of anchovy bread. When we returned, our quest fulfilled, the library precinct was quiet and still. My master knew the incident was inauspicious, but his studies were his consuming interest, and he chose to ignore the implications. But I did not, and nor did the people of Alexandria. Rumours of the matter circulated swiftly, some more creative than accurate. One account, daubed upon the harbour walls and illustrated by a lively sketch, described the king's son being bent bare-bottomed over a library table and spanked with a royal flail by demon or demons unknown. The king's son was unpopular. His humiliation was regarded with general hilarity, and Ptolemy's celebrity grew. By night I floated on the winds above the palace, conversing with the djinn. "What news?"
"News, Bartimaeus, of the king's son. His brow is heavy with wrath and fear. He mutters daily that Ptolemy might send a demon to destroy him and seize the throne. The danger pulses in his temple like a beating drum."
"But my master lives only for his writing. He has no interest in the crown."
"Even so. The king's son chews on the problem late at night and over wine. He sends emissaries out in search of men that might aid him quash this threat."
"Affa, I thank you. Fly well."
"Fly well, Bartimaeus."
Ptolemy's cousin was a fool and a sot, but I understood his fears. He himself was not a magician. The magicians of Alexandria were ineffectual shadows of the great ones of the past, under whom I'd toiled. The ancient pharaohs had traditionally relied upon their priests for such services, and the Greek dynasty had seen no reason to alter this policy. But whereas in the past talented individuals had made their way to Egypt to ply their trade, allowing the empire to grow strong on the backs of weeping djinn, that time had long since gone. The army was weaker than for generations, and mostly far away. In comparison, Ptolemy was powerful indeed. No question the king's son would be vulnerable should my master decide to overthrow him. Time passed. I watched and waited. The king's son found his men. Money was paid. One moonlit night, four assassins stole into the palace gardens and paid a call upon my master. As I may have mentioned, their visit was of short duration. The king's son had taken the precaution of being away from Alexandria that night. He was out in the desert hunting. When he returned, he was greeted first by a flock of carrion birds wheeling in the skies above the crocodile gate, then by the hanging corpses of three assassins. Their feet brushed against the plumes of his chariot as he passed into the city. Face mottled white and crimson, the prince retired to his chambers and was not seen for days. "Master," I said, "your life remains at risk. You must leave Alexandria."
"Quite impossible, Reckitt, as you know. The library is here."
"Your cousin is your implacable foe. He will try again."
"And you will be here to foil him, Reckitt. I have every confidence in you."
"The assassins were but men. The next who come will not be human."
"I am sure you will cope. Do you have to squat so? It distresses me."
"I'm an imp today. Imps squat." "Listen," I said, "your confidence in me is gratifying, but frankly I can do without it. Just as I can do without being in the firing line when a married comes knocking on your door." He chuckled into his goblet.
"A married? I think you overestimate the ability of our court magicians. A one-legged moolah, I can believe."
"Your cousin casts his net wider. He drinks long with ambassadors from Rome, and Rome, from what I hear, is where the action is right now. Every hedge magician from here to the Tigris is hastening there in search of glory." Ptolemy shrugged.
"So my cousin puts himself in Rome's pocket. Why should they attack me?"
"So that he will be for ever in their debt. And meanwhile, I'll be dead." I let off a gust of sulphur in annoyance. My master's blithe absorption in his studies could be rather galling. "It's all right for you," I cried. "You can summon up any number of us to protect your skin. What we suffer doesn't matter a fig." I folded my wings over my snout, in the manner of a huffy bat, and hung from the bedroom rafter.
"Reckitt, you have saved my life twice over. You know how grateful I am to you."
"Words, words, words. Don't mean nout." Bit of Egyptian street argo crept in here. Well, I was riled.
"That's hardly fair. You know the direction of my work. I wish to understand the mechanisms that divide us, human and jinni. I seek to redress the balance, build trust between us.
Yeah, yeah. And while you do, I'm guarding your back and emptying out your privy pot.
Now you're making it up. And Hotep does that.
I'm speaking figuratively.
My point is, whenever I'm in your world, I'm trapped. You call the shots. Trust doesn't enter into it.
The imp glared out through the membrane of its wing and let out another sulphurous eruption.
Will you stop doing that? I've got to sleep in this room tonight. So you doubt my sincerity, do you?
If you want my opinion, Master, all your talk of reconciliation between our peoples is nothing but hot air.
Is that so?
My master's tone of voice hardened.
Very well, Reckitt. I take that as a challenge. I believe my studies are coming to the point when I can perhaps act as well as talk. As you know, I have studied accounts of the northern tribes. The practice there is for magicians and spirits to meet halfway. From what you and the others have told me, I think I can go one better than that.
He threw his goblet aside, got up, and began pacing around the chamber. The imp lowered its wings uneasily. What do you mean? I don't follow you.
Oh, you won't have to follow me, the boy said. Quite the reverse. When I'm ready, I'll be following you.
Chapter 13. Nathaniel. The untoward incidents that took place during the Prime Minister's party at Richmond were swift and confusing, and it took some time to discover what had happened. Witnesses among the party guests were few, since when the carnage had erupted in the skies above, most had taken shelter head-first in the rose beds and ornamental ponds. However, after Mr. Devereux had gathered the magicians responsible for estate security, and they in their turn had summoned the demons guarding the perimeter, a picture of sorts emerged. It appeared that the alarm had been set off when a jinni, in the form of a limping frog, broke through the estate nexus. It was closely pursued by a large pack of demons, which harried their prey remorselessly as it fled across the lawns. The estate demons had quickly joined the melee, valiantly attacking anything that moved, so that one or two of the invaders were soon destroyed, together with three guests, an under-butler, and much of the antique statuary on the south lawns, behind which the frog took shelter for a time. In the chaos, the frog escaped by breaking into the house itself, at which the other invaders turned about and fled the scene. Their identity, and that of their masters, remained obscure. By contrast, the identity of the frog's master was soon established. Too many people had observed the events in the mansion's vestibule for John Mandrake to escape detection. Shortly after midnight he was hauled up before Mr. Devereux, Mr. Mortensen, and Mr. Collins, the three most senior ministers remaining at the house, and admitted having given the jinni in question the freedom to return to him at any time. Under harsh questioning, Mr. Mandrake was then forced to give some details of the operation in which his demon had been engaged. The name of Mr. Clive Jenkins was mentioned, and five haulers were promptly dispatched to his London flat. In due course they returned. Mr. Jenkins was not at home. His whereabouts was unknown. Since Mandrake knew nothing about what his jinni had discovered, and since summoning the injured Bartimaeus immediately might well destroy its essence, without any answer being forthcoming, the matter was abandoned for the present. Mandrake was ordered to appear before the council 3 days later, to summon his slave for interrogation. In the meantime, the young magician bore the weight of general displeasure. The Prime Minister was beside himself with fury at the loss of his Grecian statuary, while Mr. Collins, who at the outset of the alarm had been the first to leap into the duck pond, only to be half-drowned beneath one of the heavier lady guests, regarded him balefully from beneath his wad of toweling. The third minister, Mr. Mortensen, had suffered no particular injury, but had disliked Mandrake for years. Together they condemned him for his irresponsible and secretive conduct, and hinted at a broad range of punishments, though the details were left until the forthcoming council meeting. Mr. Mandrake made no response to the accusations. Pale-faced, he departed the mansion, and was driven back to London. The following day Mr. Mandrake breakfasted alone. Miss Piper, reporting as usual for the early morning briefing, found the door barred by a manservant.
The minister was indisposed. He would see her in the office later. Disconcerted, she took her leave. With leaden steps, the magician proceeded to his study. The door guard, attempting a mild jocularity, found itself blasted by a spasm. Mandrake sat for a long while at his desk, staring at the wall. Presently he picked up his telephone and dialed a number.
"Hello? Jane Farrar's office? Could I speak with her, please?" "Yes, it's Mandrake."
"Oh. I see. Very well." The receiver was slowly returned to its cradle. Well, he had tried to warn her. That she had refused to speak to him was hardly his fault. The night before he had done his best to keep her name out of it, but to no avail. Their altercation had been seen. No doubt she would now be reprimanded, too. He felt only mild regret at this. All thought of the beautiful Miss Farrar filled him with a strange repulsion. The real stupidity of it was that this trouble might have been prevented if he'd just done what Farrar said. Almost certainly Bartimaeus would have had information on the Jenkins plot that would have helped placate Devereux. He should have squeezed it out of his slave without a second thought. But instead, he had let him go. It was absurd. The Jinni was nothing but a thorn in his flesh. Abusive, argumentative, feeble, and because of his birth name, potentially a fatal threat. He should have destroyed him while he was unable to fight back. How simple it should have been! Blank-eyed, he stared at the papers on his desk. Sentimental and weak. Perhaps Farrar was right. John Mandrake, Minister of the Government, had acted against his own interests. Now he was vulnerable to his enemies. Even so, no matter how much cold fury he tried to muster, against Bartimaeus, against Farrar, and most of all against himself, he knew he could not have done otherwise. The sight of the Jinni's small, broken body had shocked him too much. It had prompted an impulsive decision. And this was the shattering event. Far more significant than the threats and spite of his colleagues. For years his life had been a fabric of calculations. It was by remorseless dedication to work that Mandrake derived his identity. Spontaneity had become alien to him. But now, in the shadow of his single, unconsidered action, the prospect of work suddenly did not appeal. Elsewhere this morning, armies were clashing, the ministries were humming, there was much to be done. John Mandrake felt listless, floating, suddenly detached from the demands of his name and office. A train of thought from the previous night recurred in his mind. An image. Sitting with his tutor, Muslutchens, long ago, happily sketching in the garden on a summer's day. She sat beside him, laughing, hair gleaming in the light. The vision flickered like a mirage. It vanished. The room was bare and cold. In due course, the magician left his study. In its circle of blackened wood, the door guard flinched from him as he passed. The day did not go well for Mandrake. At the Information Ministry, a tartly worded memo from Ms. Farrar's office awaited him. She had decided to raise an official complaint regarding his refusal to interrogate his demon, an act which was likely to prove detrimental to the police investigation. No sooner had Mandrake finished reading this than a somber deputation from the Home Office arrived, bearing an envelope with a black ribbon. Mr. Collins wished to question him about a serious disturbance in St. James's Park the previous evening. The details were ominous for Mandrake. A fleeing frog. A savage demon set free from its prism. A number of fatalities in the crowd. A minor riot had ensued, with commoners destroying a portion of the fair. Tension on the streets was still high. Mandrake was asked to prepare a defence in time for the council meeting in 2 days' time. He agreed without discussion. He knew the thread supporting his career was fraying fast. During meetings, the eyes of his deputies were amused and scathing. One or two went so far as to suggest he summon his jinni immediately to limit the political damage. Mandrake, stony-faced and stubborn, refused. All day he was irritable and distracted. Even Miss Piper gave him a wide berth.
By late afternoon, when Mr. Makepeace rang to remind him of their appointment, Mandrake had had enough. He departed his office for the day. For some years, ever since the affair of Gladstone's staff, Mandrake had been a close associate of the playwright, Mr. Quentin Makepeace. There was good reason to be so. Above all things, the Prime Minister loved theatre, and Mr. Makepeace consequently exerted great influence upon him. By pretending to share his leader's joy, Mandrake had managed to maintain a bond with Devereux that other, more intolerant members of the council could only envy. But it came at a price. More than once, Mandrake had found himself cajoled into appearing into dreadful amateur productions at Richmond, prancing about the stage in chiffon leggings or bulbous pantaloons, and, on one terrible, never-to-be-forgotten occasion, swinging from a harness wearing wings of sparkly gauze. Mandrake had borne his colleague's merriment stoically. Devereux's goodwill mattered more. In return for his support, Quentin Makepeace had frequently offered Mandrake counsel, and Mandrake had found him surprisingly astute, quick to pick up on interesting rumours, accurate in his predictions of the Prime Minister's fluctuating moods. Many times he had gained advantage by following the playwright's advice. But in recent months, as his work commitments escalated, Mandrake had become weary of his companion and resentful of the time wasted nurturing Devereux's enthusiasms. He had no time for trivialities. For weeks he had avoided accepting Makepeace's invitation to call. Now, dead-eyed and rudderless, he resisted no longer. A servant let him into the quiet house. Mandrake crossed the hall, passing beneath pink-tinged chandeliers, and a monumental oil of the playwright leaning in his satin dressing-gown against a pile of self-penned works. Keeping his eyes averted, he always considered the gown a little short, Mandrake descended the central staircase. His shoes padded soundlessly on the thick pile carpet. The walls were hung with framed posters from theatres across the world. First night, world premiere, Mr. Makepeace's pleasure to present. Silently, a dozen adverts screamed their message down. At the foot of the stairs, a studded iron door led to the playwright's workroom. Even as he knocked, the door was flung open. A broad and beaming face looked out.
"John, my boy! Excellent! I am so pleased. Lock the door behind you. We shall have tea with a twist of peppermint. You look as though you need reviving."
Mr. Makepeace was a whirl of little movements, precise, defined, balletic. His diminutive frame spun and bobbed, pouring the tea, sprinkling the peppermint, restless as a little bird. His face sparkled with vigour, his red hair shone. His smile twitched repeatedly, as if reflecting on a secretive delight. As usual, his clothes expressed his buoyant personality. Tan shoes, a pair of pea-green trousers with maroon check, a bright yellow waistcoat, a pink cravat, a loose-fitting linen shirt with pleats upon the sleeves. Today, however, the sleeves were rolled up above the elbows, and cravat and waistcoat were concealed behind a stained white apron. Evidently Mr. Makepeace was hard at work. With a tiny spoon he stirred the tea, tapped it twice upon the glass, and handed the result to Mandrake.
"There!" he cried. "Get that down you. Now, John!"
His smile was tender, solicitous.
"Little birds tell me all is not well."
Briefly, without elaboration, Mandrake mentioned the events of the past few hours. The smaller man tutted and cooed with sympathy.
"Disgraceful!" he cried at last. "And you were only doing your duty. But fools like Farrah are all too ready to tear you to pieces first chance they get. You know what their problem is, John?"
He gave a significant pause.
"Envy. We are surrounded by envious minnows who resent our talents. I get this reaction all the time in the theatre, critics carping at my efforts."
Mandrake grunted.
"Well, you'll put them in their place again tomorrow," he said, "with the premiere." "Indeed I shall, John. Indeed I shall. But you know, sometimes government is so friendless. I expect you feel that, don't you? You feel as if you're on your own. But I am your friend, John.
I respect you, even if no one else does.
Thanks, Quentin. I'm not sure it's quite as bad as...
You see, you've got something they haven't.
Know what it is?
Vision. I've always seen that in you. You're clear-sighted and ambitious, too. I read that in you. Yes, I do.
Mandrake looked down at his tea, which he disliked.
Well, I don't know. I want to show you something, John. A little magical experiment. I want to get your opinion. See if you can see... Well, come on. No time like the present. Could you take along that iron imp spike beside you?
Thanks.
Yes, you can bring your tea.
With short, swift steps, Mr. Makepeace led the way toward an inner arch. In some perplexity, Mandrake trailed after. A magical experiment? He had never observed Makepeace do more than the most basic spells. He had always assumed him to be a fairly minor conjurer. That was everyone's opinion. What, then, was he? He turned the corner and halted. With difficulty, he prevented his tea-glass tumbling from his fingers. His eyes widened in the half-light. His mouth hung open.
"What do you think? What do you think, my boy?"
Mr. Makepeace was grinning at his shoulder. For a long moment Mandrake could not speak, but simply cast his eyes around the chamber. Previously it had been home to the playwright's homage to himself. A collection of trophies, awards, newspaper cuttings, photographs, and curios. Now this shrine had gone. A single electric bulb cast dim radiance. The room contained two pentacles, carefully drawn on the concrete floor. The first, the magician's, was of standard size, but the other was much larger. And it was occupied. A metal chair sat in the centre of the summoning pentacle, fixed to the floor with four great bolts. The chair was made of iron, its limbs thick and heavily soldered. It gleamed faintly in the half-light. Sitting upon it, with canvas straps constraining wrists and ankles, was a man.
"Quite a picture, is it not?"
Mr. Makepeace could scarcely contain his excitement. He practically skipped and danced at Mandrake's side. The prisoner was conscious. Panicked eyes gazed at them. A rough gag covered his mouth and part of a moustache and beard. His blonde hair was disordered, a faint bruise glistened on one cheek. He wore commoner's clothes, ripped about the collar.
Who is he?
Mandrake could scarcely speak.
This beauty?
Mr. Makepeace chuckled. He pranced to the small pentacle and began lighting the candles.
Of course, you know there's been trouble with the Battersea steelworkers. They've gone on strike, apparently. Spend their time having parties in the street outside the factory. Well, late last night my agents found this fine fellow holding forth to the protesters from the back of a truck. In good voice he was. A real orator. Harangued the crowd for 20 minutes about how they've got to revolt, how the time was fast approaching when the magicians would pack their bags. Got a nice round of applause at the end. Well, despite his pretty words, he wouldn't stay out all night with the workers in the cold, and presently he set off home. So my boys followed him and knocked him on the head when no one was looking. Brought him down here. I'm going to need that imp spike, if you don't mind. No, on second thoughts, you have it. I'll have my hands full with the summoning.
Mandrake's head spun.
What summoning?
What? Astonishment gave way to agitation.
Quentin, do you mind telling me exactly what you're doing?
I'll do better than that. I'll show you.
Mr. Makepeace finished lighting the candles, scanned the runes and incense bowls, and hopped across to the captive's chair. With delicate fingers he manipulated the gag.
Don't like to use this, but I had to keep him quiet. The chap became quite hysterical. Now you...
The smile vanished from his face.
Answer my questions precisely, or you know what'll happen.
The gag was whisked away. Colour returned to constricted lips.
What's your name?
A cough, a gasp.
Nicholas Droser.
Occupation?
shop worker.
So you're a commoner?
Yes.
And you're a political activist in your spare time?
Yes, sir.
Very well. What is the shrivelling fire, and when is it applied? The question came arrow-quick. The prisoner flinched. Incomprehension filled his face.
I don't know.
Come on, come on, answer me, or my friend here will goad you with his stick. Mandrake frowned in anger.
Make peace. Stop this now.
A moment, my boy. The magician loomed close to his captive. So even with the threat of pain, you persist with your lie?
It is not a lie. I swear it. I have never heard of that fire. Please.
A broad grin. Good. That'll do. With swift motions, the gag was replaced. Makepeace hopped back to the other pentacle. You heard all that, John? Mandrake's face was white with shock and rising disgust.
Makepeace, what is the purpose of this exhibition? We cannot pluck men off the streets and subject them to torture.
The playwright snorted.
Torture? He's all right.
He's barely been touched. Besides, you heard him. He's an agitator, a threat to the nation. But I intend him no malice. He's just helping me with a little experiment. Observe. He adopted a dramatic pose. His fingers twitched, as if about to conduct an orchestra. Mandrake started forward.
I insist that—
Careful, John. You know better than to fool about when a summoning's in progress. With this, the playwright began a rapid incantation. The light dimmed. From nowhere, a gentle breeze stirred the candle flames. Two rooms away, the iron door jolted in its sockets. Mandrake stepped back, instinctively raising the spike he carried. Subconsciously, he listened to the words. Latin, a fairly typical summons, the usual clauses. The demon's name, Borello. But wait, what was that bit? In corpus viri? Into the vessel that you find there? Obedient to the vessel's will? This was odd and unfamiliar. The incantation finished. Mandrake's gaze swiveled to the chair, where a dark shadow flickered. Now it was gone. The man's body jerked, as if all its muscles had tensed, then relaxed. Mandrake waited. The breeze subsided. The light bulb flared once more. The young man sat inert and passive. His eyes were closed. Mr. Makepeace lowered his hands. He winked at Mandrake. Now then. He took a step forward. Mandrake gasped, cried out a warning.
Wait, you fool! The demon's there! It's suicide to—
Calm and slow as a noonday cat. Makepeace stepped out of his circle and into the other. Nothing happened. Grinning, he once more removed the gag and patted the captive gently on one cheek. Mr. Drew, wake up! This is no time for sleeping. Languorously, the young man stirred, hands and feet stretched against their bonds. His eyes opened and stared about them dreamily. He seemed to have difficulty recollecting his situation. Fascinated despite himself, Mandrake moved a little closer. "Hold that stick ready," Makepeace said. "Things may go wrong." He bent near, spoke sweetly. "What is your name, friend?"
"Nicholas Drew."
"Is that your only name? Think deeply. Do you have another?" A pause. The man's face furrowed.
"Yes, I do."
"And what is it?"
"Borello."
"Ah, good. Tell me, Nicholas, what is your occupation?"
"Shop worker."
"And what is the shriveling fire? When is it applied?" A brief frown of puzzlement gave way to bland assurance.
"It is the penalty for disobedience, should we purposefully fail in our charge. Our master puts our essence to the torch. Ah, we fear it."
"Very good. Thank you." Mr. Makepeace turned away, leapt carefully over the nearest chalk marks, and approached John Mandrake, whose face had been robbed of expression.
"What do you think, my boy? Is it not a fascinating situation?"
I don't know. It is a clever trick.
It is more than a trick. The demon has lodged itself within the man. It is trapped inside, as if he were the pentacle. Did you not hear? And the demon's knowledge is at the man's command. Suddenly he knew the meaning of the shriveling fire. He had knowledge, where before had just been blankness. Now consider the implications.
Mandrake frowned. The feat is morally dubious. This fellow is an unwilling victim. Besides, he is a commoner. He cannot properly use the demon's information.
Aha! Perceptive as ever. Forget the moral dimension for a moment. Imagine if...
What is he doing? Mandrake was studying the captive, who seemed to have newly recognized his surroundings. Agitation had returned to the face. He struggled with his bonds. Once or twice he turned his head violently from side to side, like a dog worrying at a flea. Makepeace shrugged.
Perhaps he senses the demon inside. Perhaps it talks within him. Hard to tell. I have not tried it with a commoner before.
You have used others?
A single one only. A volunteer. That union has worked extremely well.
Mandrake rubbed his chin. The sight of the writhing captive unsettled him, disrupting his intellectual interest. He could not think what to say. Mr. Makepeace had no such problems.
The implications, as I say, are immense. Notice how I entered the pentacle unharmed. The demon was powerless to stop me, since it was within an altogether different prison. Now I wanted you to see this, John, with the utmost urgency, because I trust you, just as you, I hope, trust me. And if...
Please!
A plaintive cry from the figure in the chair.
I can't bear it! Oh, it whispers! It drives me mad!
Mandrake flinched.
He is suffering. The demon must be dismissed.
Shortly, shortly. Probably he lacks the mental ability to constrain its voice.
The captive wriggled anew.
I'll tell you all I know, about the commoners, about our plans. I can give you information.
Makepeace made a face.
Tush! You can give us nothing that our spies don't already know. Cease your hollering. I have a headache.
No, I can tell you of the commoners' alliance, of their ringleaders.
We know them all, their names, their wives, their families. They are ants to be stepped on when we choose. Now, I have vital matters to discuss here.
But you do not know this. A fighter from the old resistance lives. She hides in London. I have seen her hours ago. I can take you to the place.
That is all ancient history.
Mr. Makepeace took the iron spike from Mandrake's fingers and weighed it casually in his palm.
I am a patient man, Mr. Drew, but you begin to irk me. If you do not cease...
Wait a moment.
John Mandrake's voice had altered. Its tone halted the playwright in his tracks.
What resistance fighter is this? A woman? Yes, yes, a girl. Her name is Kitty Jones, although she goes now by another name. Ah, will you stop? You're whispering!
He groaned and thrashed beneath his bonds. A faint rushing sounded in Mandrake's head. For a moment he felt dizzy, as if he were about to fall. His mouth was dry.
Kitty Jones? You lie! No, I swear it! Release me and I will take you to her!
Is this line of questioning really necessary?
Mr. Makepeace wore a petulant frown.
The resistance is long defunct. Please concentrate on what I say, John. It is extremely important, especially in your current situation. John! John!
Mandrake did not hear him. He saw Bartimaeus wearing the apparel of a dark-skinned boy. He saw him standing in a cobbled courtyard years before. He heard the boy speak. The golem seized her, incinerated her in seconds. Kitty Jones was dead. The Jinni had told him so. Mandrake had believed him. And now, out of the past, the boy's sober expression suddenly shifted horribly into a leer of contempt. Mandrake leaned over the captive.
Where did you see her? Tell me, and you shall go free. The Frog Inn, Chiswick. She works there. She has the name of Clara Bell. Now, please.
Quintin, be so good as to dismiss the demon and release this man immediately. I must depart. The playwright had become quiet, suddenly withdrawn.
Certainly, John, if you wish it. But will you not wait?
I strongly advise you to listen to what I have to say. Forget the girl. There are more important things. I want to discuss this experiment.
Later, Quintin, later.
Mandrake was white-faced. He was already at the arch.
But where are you going? Not back to work?
Mandrake spoke through gritted teeth.
Hardly. I have a summoning of my own that I have to perform.
Chapter 14. Bartimaeus. Time, as I may have mentioned once or twice, does not really exist in the other place. Even so, you know full well when you're being short-changed. And I had scarcely been reabsorbed by the nourishing energies of the maelstrom when I felt the cruel tug of a summons once again, sucking me out like yolk drawn from an egg, plunging me back upon the hard and bitter earth. Already! And my essence had hardly begun to heal. My last activities upon the material world had been so painful, so perilous to my essence, that I could barely remember them. But one thing was clear enough. My numbing, cursed weakness. How I, whose power scattered the magicians of Nimrud, who set the Barbary coast aflame, who sent cruel Amit, Ko, and Jabor spinning to their doom, how I, that same Bartimaeus, had been reduced to fleeing as a miserable, no-good frog, unable to trade the smallest detonation with a gang of hireling herons. During the whole debacle I had been too near death to truly feel the righteous anger that was my due, but I felt it now, my very being frothed with it. I could dimly recall my master dismissing me. Probably he disliked the mess I was making on his floor. Perhaps my decrepitude had embarrassed him at last. Well, whatever the reason, it hadn't taken him long to change his mind. Fine. I was through with him. We would both go to our deaths. I'd use his name against him now, come what may. My last desire was to see him squirm. And I wasn't going to go out as a paltry amphibian, either. In the few short hours I'd been away from Earth, the other place had worked its magic. I'd managed to absorb a little energy. It wouldn't last long, but I was going to put it to good use. As I materialized, I drew what was left of my essence into a form that reflected my emotions with simple purity. E.g., a big horned demon with muscles like melons and lots of teeth. It was the full works. You name it, I'd got it. Brimstone, spear-tail, wings, hooves, claws, even a couple of whips thrown in. My eyes were burning fish-hooks. My skin glowed like cooling lava. Not particularly original, but as a statement of intent it did the job nicely. I erupted into the room with a roll of thunder fit to send the living dead scuttling to their coffins. This was followed by a howl of famished rage, the kind uttered by Anubis's jackals as they prowled about the Memphis tombs, only a bit louder and longer, a vile noise, unnaturally prolonged. In fact, I was still in the middle of my ululation when I caught sight of the figure in the pentacle opposite, and was completely put off my stroke. The barnstorming roar contracted into a wobbling gargle that shot up a couple of octaves and ended in a falsetto squeak with a question mark on the end. The demon, which had been busily rearing up, leather wings akimbo, whips a-cracking, froze in an unstable posture with its backside protruding. The wings slumped, the whips drooped limply. The billowing brimstone cloud petered away into a timorous dribble that drifted discreetly out of view behind my hooves. I stopped and stared.
"All right," the girl said tartly. "Quit the silly faces. Have you never been summoned by a woman before?"
The demon lifted a brawny finger and pushed its jaw back into position.
"Yes, but—" "But nothing. Stop making such a fuss."
A forked tongue, identical to the tail below, issued from the demon's mouth and moistened its dry lips.
But, hold on a minute. And what horrible kind of manifestation do you call this, anyhow?
she went on. "That noise, that stench, all those folds and knobbly warts and things. What are you trying to prove?" Her eyes narrowed. "I think you're compensating for something."
"Listen," I began. "This is an established, traditional form that..."
"Traditional nothing. Where are your clothes?"
"Clothes?" I said weakly. "I don't normally bother with them in this guise."
"Well, you could put on a pair of shorts, at least. You're not decent."
"I'm not sure they'd go with the wings."
The demon frowned, blinked.
"Hold on, enough of this."
"Lederhosen would. They'd complement the leather."
With difficulty, I gathered my thoughts.
"Stop! Forget the clothes. The point is, what are you doing here? Summoning me? I don't understand. This is all wrong."
In my perplexity, all attempts at established traditional terrors ceased. Much to the relief of my wounded essence, the towering demon shrank and shimmered and adjusted itself down to fit the pentacle more snugly. My leather wings became two shoulder nubs, and my tail retracted out of sight.
"Why is it wrong?" the girl asked.
"It's just another one of those master-servant things you were telling me about when last we met. You know, I'm the master, you're the slave. I give the orders, you obey without question. Remember how it works now?"
"Sarcasm doesn't go with a pretty face," I said, "so feel free to make lots more comments along those lines.
You know perfectly well what I mean.
You're not a magician."
She smiled sweetly and gestured about us.
"Really? In what way do I not fit the bill?"
The snug-fit demon looked left. The snug-fit demon looked right. Unnervingly, she had a point. There was I, imprisoned in a pentacle. There was she, standing in another. And all around sat the usual paraphernalia. Candelabra, incense bowls, chalk sticks, big book lying on a table. It was an otherwise empty room, without curtains on the window. A big round moon shone high above, splashing a silver light across our faces. Except for the smooth, raised section in the middle, where the runes and circle had been painted, the floor was of warped, irregular boards. Behind the taint of rosemary, the whole place smelled of damp, disuse, and assorted rodents. So far, so ordinaire. I'd seen this dismal view a thousand times. All that ever changed was the view out of the window. No, what was preoccupying me was the summoner herself, the so-called magician, Kitty Jones. There she was, large as life and twice as confident, standing hands on hips with a grin as wide as the Nile estuary. Exactly as I'd portrayed her all those times while annoying Mandrake. Or almost so, I sometimes exaggerated the curves. Her long dark hair had been chopped back level with her ears. Perhaps her face was a little thinner than I remembered. But she looked in far better shape than when I'd last seen her, hobbling down the street after her triumph with the golem. How long had it been since then? 3 years, no more. But time seemed to have passed differently for her, somehow. Her eyes held a calmness of earned knowledge. Her outfit wasn't the issue for me right then. But for the completists among you, this was her attire. She wore a black tunic and trouser combo, very fetching, if you were that way inclined. Her tunic was open at the throat. She wore no jewellery. Her feet were encased in big white trainers. How old was she now? Around 18, at a guess. I never thought to ask her. And now it's too late. All very well. But still, she couldn't have summoned me. I knew this. The pocket demon shook its head. "It's a trick," I said slowly. I glanced about, my gaze probing the corners of the room with rapier-keen precision. "The real magician's here somewhere, hiding." She grinned. "What, you think I'm concealing him up my sleeve?" She shook her arm somewhat unnecessarily. "Nope, not there. Perhaps in your great age you're growing forgetful, Bartimaeus. You're the one who does the magic." I rewarded her with a suitably demonic scowl. "Say what you'd like. There's another pentacle close by. Must be. I've seen this kind of stunt pulled before. Yes, behind that door, for instance." I pointed at the only exit. There isn't. I folded my arms, all four of them. That's where he is. She shook her head, almost laughing.
I assure you he's not.
Prove it. Go open it and show me. She laughed aloud.
Step out of my pentacle, so you can tear me limb from limb? Get real, Bartimaeus.
I masked my disappointment with a huffy face.
Tsk. That's a poor excuse. He's behind there for sure.
Can't fool me. Her expressions had always been mercurial. Now they switched to one of boredom.
We're wasting time. Maybe this will convince you.
She uttered a quick five-syllable word. A lilac-coloured flame rose from the centre of my pentacle and administered a swift jab in a private area. My ceiling-high leap distracted her from my whoop of pain. At least, that was my intention. By the time I landed again, the flame had vanished. She raised an eyebrow.
Now, don't you think you should have worn a pair of trousers?
I looked at her long and deeply. You're lucky, I said, with as much dignity as I could muster, that I decided not to reverse that punitive jab against you. I know your name, Miss Jones. That gives me protection. Or have your studies not taken you that far? She shrugged.
I've heard something about that. I'm not interested in the details.
Again, I say it. You're not a magician. Magicians are obsessed with details. That's what keeps them alive. I really don't know how you survived all your other summonings.
What others? This is my first one solo.
Despite its singed bottom, from which the odour of burned toast was gently wafting, the demon had been doing its best to appear in belated command of the situation. But this new information felled it once again. We fourth-level djinn are not the easiest of spirits to summon correctly, since we are fastidious and proper and keep a sharp ear out for any small errors in the incantations. For this reason, and because of our formidable intellect and overpowering presence, generally not involving the smell of burnt toast, magicians avoid us until they have had a good deal of practice. Yet another plaintive question formed on my lips, but I let it drift away unspoken. There was little point. Whichever way I looked at it, nothing here made sense. So I tried a new and unfamiliar strategy, and stayed silent. The girl seemed taken aback by this cunning approach. After a few seconds of waiting, she realized that continuing our conversation was up to her. She drew a deep breath to settle her nerves and began to speak.
"Well, you're quite right, Bartimaeus," she said. "I am not a magician, thank goodness. And this is the one and only summoning that I ever intend to do. I've been planning it for the last 3 years."
She took another breath and waited. A dozen more questions occurred to me. Not to mention 22 possible solutions to each one, 16 resulting hypotheses and counter-theorems, 8 abstract speculations, a quadrilateral equation, 2 axioms and a limerick. That's raw intelligence for you. But I said nothing.
"This is just a means to an end," she went on. "I'm not interested in the things that the magicians want. You don't have to worry about that."
Another pause. Did I speak?
No.
I just kept stumm.
"I don't want any of that," the girl said. "I don't want to acquire vast power or wealth. I think that's all despicable."
My strategy was working, albeit with the pace of a tortoise in lead boots. I was getting an explanation.
"And I certainly don't want to subjugate enslaved spirits," she added brightly, "if that's what you're thinking."
"Not interested in subjugation." Bang went my strategy, but hey, I'd managed more than a minute's silence, which was itself some kind of record. The diminished demon fingered its burnt region gingerly, letting off little oohs and ahs of discomfort.
"You've got a funny way of going about it, then. I'm in pain here, you know."
"I was just proving a point, that's all," she said. "Look, would you mind not doing that? You're putting me off my stride."
"Doing what?"
"I was only feeling—"
"I saw quite well what you were feeling. Just stop it.
And while you're about it, can't you change into something else? That really is the most hideous incarnation. I thought you had more class."
"This? Hideous?"
I whistled.
You really haven't done many summonings, have you?
All right, then, seeing as you're so sensitive, I shall cover my modesty.
I changed into my favourite guise. Ptolemy suited me, as I felt comfortable in his